All right.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the committee for the invitation and apologize to Twain. I think I'm the lone remaining paper out, but that's in progress and on its way. I've got a bit of a vanilla title here following the symposium title. Here's an overview. I'm not covering everything I had in the abstract. It was a very, very vague abstract, actually, but I've eliminated two of those topics in the abstract in the interest of time. But here's what we're going to cover. This is sort of Animal Science 101, the importance of physiological stage and trial design. Again, Animal Nutrition 301, sophomore year. Something that Jim Muir got me very interested in the Southern Pastures meeting in Aiken that changed a trial direction in tall fescue toxicosis is are other animal models more appropriate or more feasible, more economical? I'll talk a bit on that with some tall fescue work we've done. Twain specifically invited me to talk about forage finishing and alternate finishing systems. We will hit on that at the end. And one of the major issues with those forage finishing systems are determining the endpoint of that trial. And a lot of times we're comparing apples to oranges, and it's something we really, really need to consider. And then something that I hesitate to bring up, but it's sort of the gorilla in the room, is issues with experimental units. And we're going to touch on that at the end at the risk of being crucified at the end. So we're going to go through these things, and I'm going to use a lot of the trials that we've conducted at Clemson in the last few years and at Georgia. I'm not saying these are right or wrong, but I'm very familiar with the trials, and we can use them as examples as we roll through this. So going to try to keep on time here. Monty, I know Monty's got 2 hours worth of slides. I've only got an hour and a half, so we'll be done by lunch. As the great philosopher Jerry Reeb said, we've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. So you've got to be a child of the 80s to follow that, I think. All right, again, so within animal species, age and physiological state matters. This is, again, very fundamental. It's mundane, probably. This is I pulled this out of the 1984 NRC. I admit I'm a child of the 80s. I haven't converted to the newer NRC, mainly because the tables are too hard to figure out, and I like the English system in the old NRC, and it gets me as close as I need to get. So we've got four different animal classes. For the sake of time, I'm sticking just to beef cattle here, and what you select matters from a trial standpoint. Here's the same 400-pound steer. Medium frame steer, crude protein on a percent dry matter basis, percent TDN because it's easy to think about again on a percent dry matter basis of the diet. This 400-pound steer, whether that steer gains 1.5 pounds a day or 2.5 pounds a day, has a big difference in crude protein requirements, about 11% versus almost 15%. And while both the TDN requirements are high, we're looking at a low 60 here versus a mid 70% TDN there. So again, if your animal doesn't have the potential to gain a lot, you may not be able to separate differences on high-quality forages. Or, again, it matters. The same thing, and we're going to get into this example a little more thoroughly as we go through the next few slides, is that the state of reproductive animals matters as well. I've got, as an example here, a 900-pound, 2-year-old, first calving heifer. She's lactating, milking 10 pounds of milk a day. A 1,200-pound mature cow, and by the way, we're asking this cow to gain 0.5 pound a day while she's lactating and trying to rebreed. A mature cow, 1,200 pounds, milking the same 10 pounds a day, not asking her to gain weight. But again, the scale messes this up, but mid-60s TDN for this cow, kind of a mid-50s TDN for this cow. A big fundamental difference in forage quality, and that difference can really allow us to separate trials quite a bit. And we'll get into that in about two slides as we move into a fescue reproduction model. The next slide is a slide that I've shown 200 times over the last 10 years. This is some work that Joe Boughton and Jane Parrish did at Eatonton, Georgia, and it's stocker cattle gain response to novel endophyte fescue, Max-Q fescue, a huge problem in our area of the world. And I've shown this time and time again, except in English units, to producers across the southeastern U.S. in an attempt to get them to convert toxic fescue to non-toxic fescue. I mean, you show these gains in the 150, 140% increase in in animal gains and gain per acre, gain per hectare in the spring, and equally impressive gains in the fall. But this, I would bet you that this has allowed me to convert two or three producers by showing this 200 times in the Southeast. Why? Why aren't people getting this? Because in my neck of the woods, in South Carolina, stocker cattle don't matter. We're a cow-calf producing state. The two or three people I've got converted are people who retain their own calves. These don't translate very well to reproductive responses, and that's what our producers are interested in. So we're going to talk about some models that we can use to collect those cow-calf data, that cow-calf data. This is a graph that matters, and again, it's an older graph. It's Kentucky data from 1988, and it's data that I have used to convince producers. And this is just a very simple trial, very toxic fescue, endophyte-free fescue, and then a dilution effect with 50% toxic fescue and 25% white clover. And we see this nice, even, you know, dilution effect with cow reproduction rates. So we go from kind of a mid-50s to a very acceptable high 90s, and that clover falls right in the middle, just like we teach. You know, it's perfect. The problem is you got to read that article and get into the text and get into a table to figure out that cows respond differently. Animal physiological state matters. And in this trial, what people fail to mention is that there was an animal age by forage treatment interaction. The 2 and 3 year old cows didn't respond to dilution at all. So these younger cows were more sensitive. You didn't see this increase. So these cows were more sensitive to that toxin. They had higher nutrient requirements. We don't know what the reason is, but they didn't respond. Getting back to some on-farm, the on-farm comments that Lynn made, we've done some on-farm work with extension agents, and we've seen the same thing. This is an on-farm trial. It actually was we're trying to encourage some producers to use some timed AI technology, estrosynchronization, and encourage the use of artificial insemination. And this particular trial, a big producer we finally got him to use AI. We synchronized his cows, but to do that, he moved all of his cows to his main working facility because it was convenient to the house. He had excellent facilities there, and that facility was adjacent to it was all toxic fescue. And when we got these breeding rates back, these 2 and 3 year old cows had never seen toxic fescue, and we had an abysmal, I think it was 16% reproductive rate or conception rate with that timed AI. That's not a way to encourage a producer to use timed AI, but this is how we started digging out that old Gay et al. 88 data and figuring out these 2 and 3 year old cows are much more sensitive to tall fescue. Maybe we should be utilizing those in our tall fescue work to look at more specific impacts. Maybe this is a sensitive model where we can use fewer animals or use the same number of animals and have more power in those studies. So an animal consideration that we followed up on. Same extension agent started a PhD using that train of thought, and we've looked at toxic fescue versus non-toxic fescue and exploited that estrosynchronization technique to really get at timing of the exposure and how long that exposure really impacts animal performance. Again, using an appropriate 2 and 3 year old model. These are all 2 and 3 year old cows, about 100 cows a year, 4 different treatments, so 25 animals a year, and we've repeated this over a 3-year period. So using mature cows, we probably would have seen maybe not different results, but it would have taken more cows over a longer period of time, more resources, because we wouldn't have had that many animals and that much land area, frankly, to accomplish our study. So a way to exploit estrosynchronization to time and figure out the timing of fescue toxicosis, and a way to exploit different animal ages and different nutrient requirements of those animals and use a more sensitive model to detect differences. An odd thing happened in this study as well, one of those kind of fortuitous accidents that we cursed at the time, and when we dug into the data, we found that it was fairly interesting. All of the bottom bars, these are toxic when we artificially inseminated, and then we rotated these cows to non-toxic. This was non-toxic, and we rotated it to toxic here. So this is natural service above. And the ones that are circled are natural service on toxic tall fescue. So we saw terrible natural service rates on toxic tall fescue. Terrible, terrible natural service rates over a month-long period that we couldn't attribute to the cow. So we started digging in, and lo and behold, another animal class comes in. An animal class that we never thought, due to nutrient requirements, would ever be sensitive to toxic tall fescue. We assumed that these animals were not sensitive at all, wrongly so. We started digging into the data with Mike Looper and Neil Schrick and determined that regardless of what the nutrient requirements of these animals are, they're relatively low, but these animals ended up being very sensitive to toxins, and that led us down a whole other path with Glenn Aiken but we were able to use the same tools, that timed AI tool, to allow us to examine toxic tall fescue effects with a minimum impact on conception rates, by the way. So here's a study that we were using, again, timed AI with animal scientists. This is a reproductive physiologist. Year one, year two, toxic, non-toxic. And we've altered this grazing system where the cows have never seen tall fescue. We're using this in an area of our state that is all warm season Bermuda grass and Bahia grass, overseeded with winter annuals. And we're using that timed AI tool. So we turn these animals out we collect these bulls on campus, either on toxic or non-toxic, use that timed AI effect, and we're able to minimize the number of cows we use by really focusing our timing. And then we can turn them out on non-toxic fescue and not suffer the financial losses that we would have in a normal system. So a lot of tools that we can tinker with there. Another issue that we have here is that, are we overlooking other animal models? And we'll move on past the nutritional state here and try to get into something a bit less mundane. But again, Jim Muir talked at Southern Pastures in Aiken a couple of years ago, and he suggested, really got me to thinking outside the box, or maybe not outside the box, but at least I wasn't way over in the corner anymore thinking about stocker cattle and just cow-calf models. I think you suggested using a white or a black rhino at that meeting, which really got me to thinking, Jim, but I think that was intentional to push us a bit. But in continuing with our objectives, we wanted to design a study that looked at fetal programming, and we just couldn't afford to do it. So we started thinking about small ruminants and versus cattle. And there's a lot of advantages here. We can use a greatly decreased paddock size. The infrastructure needs are a lot lower than with cattle. If we have the same number of animals, we can increase the replicates and statistical power, or even with the animals within a replicate and get a tighter mean within that replicate. One of the great things is we've started doing a lot of sacrificial trials where we're tanking those animals or we're slaughtering those animals at birth to look at fetal programming effects. With the price of cattle now, it's impossible to convince an administrator to sacrifice a calf at birth without significant funding. And if you look at the caps on USDA grants and the funding rates, the 6% funding rates on USDA grants, that's probably not going to happen. So we've been able to convince our administrators to let us sacrifice these animals on some hatch funds without hitting the pocketbook very hard. There's also a lot more potential. We talked about animal nutrient requirements, but there's a lot bigger range here, at least with sheep, to alter those nutritional requirements. You can have open ewes, non-lactating, ewes with singles, twins, and triplets, and those nutrient requirements vary greatly there. So we can change that quite a bit. And I mentioned that we were taking lambs at birth. We've done some studies where we're looking at serial sampling siblings to decrease genetic variability. So we can ultrasound ewes, pick twins, take one twin at birth, and then grow the other twin out and look at lifetime effects on those animals. So it's a nice animal model that you can fit nicely into grazing or, as I'll show here in a bit, tall fescue seed feeding research. Again, not saying what we're doing is right, but this is just a little different way to think about the animal component of a trial and sampling those animals. Okay. So let's go through this list real quickly, some of the advantages. And this is a photo that I got from Jane Parrish when she was working with Joe Boughton. This is a nice Max-Q. This is the initial non-toxic tall fescue work that was done at Eatonton, Georgia. It was done with a sheep model to start and then moved into a stocker model with seed production increases. And that's very deliberate. We'll show the numbers here in a minute. But the limited facility here, this is a corrugated tin shade, poly net wire that's $150 a strand and above ground water tanks. So it's almost no facility investments. And here's the weighing facility that we use at Clemson when we run lamb studies. We've done some chicory anthelmintic studies and a fetal programming study I'll show you here in a bit. Panels and a hog scale. That's some poly wire around the edges to keep our campus vet happy and make him think that we're going to keep coyotes out with it. So for animal health. So there's some excellent proof of concept and variety screen potential for small ruminants because of the limited size that you need for these animals. So this shouldn't be a question mark. This is that tall fescue study was published in 2003. A bit of a typo there that I overlooked. But it also can allow you to test additional cultivars under grazing conditions. In this particular study, they screened five endophyte by variety combinations in a very small area, about a 3 acre pasture at Eatonton, Georgia. So here's the study where they tested these five endophyte by variety combinations. This was published in Journal Animal Science. Two reps each, minimal reps. Again, it's a proof of concept study, but 0.11 hectares for each of those paddocks. And the total seed for each treatment, so two reps, 0.11 hectares, was 7.4 kilograms of seed. A great thing when you have very, very limited seed. When this was blown up to a stocker trial 2 years later, again, the same reps, same number of reps, the same number of variety endophyte combinations, but much larger paddocks for the same number of testers. And it required about, by my calculations, about 67 kilograms of seed. So when you're ramping seed production up, sheep almost become a necessity to do this in any kind of timing, any kind of rapid fashion at all. There's a lot of other opportunities here, and I'm focusing on sheep and not goats just because the diet overlap is a lot closer with sheep and cattle, and cattle's our target species typically in South Carolina. But we've done a lot of anthelmintic work, or a lot's been done. Tom Terrell at Fort Valley State, a lot of people have looked at Cerisa lespides and the tans in that. There's been a fair amount of work with the sesquiterpene lactones in chicory as worming agents for sheep and goats, both. Do these translate to cattle? I don't know, but it's a nice proof of concept, and we've got different nematode species, obviously, in cattle, but it's something that we should take forward and at least look at in a different species in this case. I've got a question mark here intentionally this time. Can these be used for regulatory screening, low lignin alfalfa, other value-added traits? I don't know if this is feasible or not from a regulatory standpoint, but it's certainly an option. And again, we can tank these animals. We can sacrifice these animals at the end if USDA requires it, and we're not out on a ridiculous sum of money. There are some great opportunities here to screen for toxicity impacts. And I'll go into a study very quickly to show you some work that we've done. I talked about serial sampling siblings and looking at decreased paddock needs, paddock size needs, and seed needs. We've done a little bit. There's a lot of interest now in fetal programming, the impacts of nutrient restriction on in utero performance of animals. And we were dying to do some tall fescue work with fetal programming. We started looking at the land area it would take to do this, and all of our cows were tied up in other projects, and we started looking at the cost, and it wasn't feasible. So we, again, I'm blaming Jim Muir for this, we moved to a sheep model after hearing that talk. And I'm going to give you, this is the only materials and methods slide I'm going to give. This is just to show you what we've done. We used just 20 Southdown ewes. We made it to one ram. We actually used a few more than this, but we selected 20. And at day 35, we ultrasounded those transrectally. We picked 20 ewes with twins, basically, that were bred in a very tight period. And then we fed those ewes a toxic dose of fescue or endophyte-free fescue. And we worked with Glenn Aiken to determine this toxic level of seed. put it in a total mixed ration. Animals are our experimental unit, which we'll talk about in a bit, but we individually fed these and incorporated them to a total mixed ration. We controlled exactly how many calories they got, and we fed them about 38% seed. Again, all of them got the same amount of calories, all of them got the same amount of protein. We just altered the seed content. Now, the reason I bring this up is because for 20 experimental units, these sheep ate 1.7 pounds of seed a day, 3,000 pounds of seed over the entire trial for 20 ewes, toxic, non-toxic. If we had done this with cattle, they have a longer gestation period and a lot higher intake, 42,000 pounds of seed. At 80 cents a pound for the seed, which is what we paid, this is totally not feasible. It's impossible to do. This is, you can write a check for that, and it's not bad at all. We'll get into the animal sacrifice costs here in just a bit. But again, we took one lamb at birth, the first male twin that was born, and sacrificed that lamb and got some great fetal programming data very inexpensively and very quickly in the matter of 4 months, right? So a very quick trial. Non-toxic, toxic. They had the runt pig look with decreased blood flow. I'm sorry for the gruesome pictures, but they were humanely sacrificed. And again, huge impacts on birth weight, hot carcass weight of a 10-pound lamb, viscera. We looked at all the tissues of these lambs and did actually some gene expression analysis of these. Again, impossible to do with beef cattle, but very feasible to do with sheep. Here's a little bit on the cost. Again, lambs, they cost us about $3,000 if we had taken them all the way to weaning. Again, if we had done this with beef cattle, $18,000 worth of product if we had taken them all the way to weaning. And we've already mentioned the huge differences in seed costs. So we took something that there's no way we could have done and accomplished it in a very short period of time. And now we have justification to try to go get more money and do it with cattle. Now, talked about all the advantages of small ruminants, and now here's the reality. They're not our target species. We're usually looking at beef cattle for that, or dairy, if you're from a different part of the country. And we're not really set up for it. We don't have the infrastructure. We've got fixed, I at least have fixed paddock sizes. They're anywhere from 2 hectares up to 4 hectares, or the cow paddocks are even larger. Our water availability is set. Our handling facilities, we've got a ridiculous amount of money invested in handling facilities for cattle. Sheep don't flow through very well through those, so we've got to at least invest minimally in handling facilities. And I'm going to throw this out. Again, there are reviewer biases, both in grants and manuscripts, and I don't know if cattle will respond exactly the same as those sheep that we did with the fetal programming trial or not. So it's an animal consideration that we need to keep in mind. Like Lynn, I went back and looked at the last 3 years of just Crop Science Journal. I didn't look at all three tri-societies. And there were right at 30 trials that had been done with grazing data collected in the last 3 years, I believe I'd done. Every single one of those trials but one was conducted in Crop Science, was conducted with cow-calf pairs, stocker cattle, or dairy heifers. One trial was conducted with goats, and it was a co-species grazing trial that Lynn actually published, looking at blackberry control in perennial peanuts. So, again, is it a reviewer bias or a funding bias, or is it just that we're not thinking about it? I think it's a little bit of both, but I think it's primarily us. So, all right, got a few minutes. We're going to talk here about alternate finishing systems, and we'll wrap up very briefly with experimental units. But niche markets are growing rapidly, and we've done a fair amount of forage finishing research. I'm married to a meat scientist, and her interest is in fatty acid composition, so we collaborate a lot, and a lot of these are herd slides. But there are two challenges, really, in these alternate finishing systems from an experimental design model, and that's determining really what forage system and how supplementation impact those. That's really beyond the scope of my talk. Maybe Monty will touch on that. The big one that I want to talk about is determining finishing endpoints, and we compare. There's a big risk here. There are fundamental flaws that, from an animal standpoint, that we need to consider in these alternate finishing systems. Whether we're comparing a forage-fed system to a feedlot system, or whether we're comparing different forage species or different supplementations. Okay. So again, apples to oranges. That endpoint's related to live weight, fat thickness. Feedlot system's easy. We've got a structured system with a standard market. The forage-only system is not easy. We've got lower amounts of fat thickness. They don't grade choice at the same age. And we're marketed in a niche system, so there's no floor on carcass weight. There's no upper limit on carcass weight. There's no premium for any of that. So there's no way to determine that. So do we end the trial at equal finish, equal subcutaneous fat? Do we end the trial at equal animal age? Or do we end that trial at equal time on pasture if we're entering pastures at a different time with these cattle? And there's a lot of determinations between those, and I'm getting the hook here, so I'm gonna skip to some correlations that I want you to look at. But really, fat thickness is impossible. Feedlots have kind of a minimum fat thickness that we never reach on pasture finishing systems, so that's out. Live weight also out. They differ quite a bit. And animal age, as you'll see here, impacts a lot of things. This is a different animal age, looking at different animal ages in this treatment, 16 to 20 months, fairly narrow range as we think about these things. And just like you'd expect, the longer these animals stay on pasture, they get fatter, gain decreases, live weight increases, hot carcass weight increases, fat thickness increases, marbling score increases, all the same. But you would think all of those things drive a higher quality animal product. The reverse is true. As that animal ages, you get more collagen, and the animal gets tougher. So if we were to compare at an equal fat thickness to feedlot cattle, we're penalizing these animals in that system. So again, to wrap up with correlations, animal age is the only thing there are two things significantly correlated to, importantly correlated to tenderness, which we would determine to be carcass quality. Animal age is a positive correlation, which means the older an animal gets, the tougher it gets. So if we compare at unequal ages, we're biasing the data. And overall average daily gain is negatively correlated. So the faster these animals gain, the more tender they'll be, because we're killing them at a younger age. So an equal age is the right answer here. Just to note, quality grade and marbling score have no impact on tenderness and no impact on quality. So on these forage finish systems, equal finish means nothing, really, when it comes to quality. So what does that mean? It means that when you design a trial to compare feedlot to forage finishing, it's impossible to do it without confounding something. Even within forage types, it's difficult. Comparing an alfalfa treatment to a chicory treatment may be fairly easy. They have similar growth production curves. But when you throw in cowpea, a warm season, or pearl millet, where you're grazing a totally different time of the year, all of a sudden you're confounded, and there's nothing you can do, unless you have animals born at different dates. So, okay. I knew I was going to skip through the supplementation. I'm going to end with the experimental units. I hope we discuss this in the roundtable unit. Monty and I talked about it in the posters yesterday, just visiting with each other. But what's the experimental unit of animal grazing trials? If it's agronomic data and we're looking at gain per hectare or grazing days per hectare, we're looking at paddock as the experimental unit. But what if we're just looking at animal performance only? How do we replicate that? I'm not saying it's right or wrong. Monty and I talked about we lose a lot of data particularly when we average all those average daily gains into one number. Or thinking back to the carcass data, when you've got a large variability in marbling within a paddock, you're losing that data or at least masking that data when you look at one single average. So we've been using some models where we use animal as the experimental unit in supplementation with Kalen Gates. But paddock as in a split plot type arrangement where we're mixing those treatments, and when we have a main effect, a subplot effect, and we're looking specifically at interactions. So there's some things we can do there. All right, Twain. In summary, that physiological age certainly can dramatically impact our research results, how we interpret those results, and how producers how we encourage producers to adopt those results. It's something that seems mundane, but it's critical. Small ruminants, I think sheep and goats, should be considered much more frequently for pilot projects or for determining more fundamental animal physiology responses. And I think we need to be very careful and think through these forage finishing, alternate marketing type research. Fundamental flaws are easy to make, and sometimes it's impossible. You have to make compromises to design those trials depending on what your objectives are. Again, to wrap up with, experimental units are likely going to differ, and I hate to say this, if you publish in crop science versus theriogenology versus meat science, those experimental units will almost certainly differ depending on where you submit that article. All right, with that, I'm going to stop. One quick question, and then we'll... I'm sorry, Ken. Yes? There's certainly different selection. Most of what we've done has been monoculture systems. Maybe there's still different rates of passage. There are fundamental differences, yes. But again, for pilot projects or proof of concept projects, or projects where there are pretty large expenses, I think it's a good starting point. If for nothing else than preliminary data to move on to funding with a target species, hopefully.
Well, thank John.